that Hillary couldn't locate, and, just as important, that his much narrower focus within the Electoral College provided a viable path to victory. Beyond her confidence in the blue wall and her own data-driven strategy and tactics, Trump was giving Hillary reason to feel good about the possibility that he would implode. She was counting on strong support from women. There were endless stories about his mistreatment of them. She was courting diverse constituencies. Trump was attacking a Mexican-American judge, Gonzalo Curiel, over his heritage. And Trump's paeans to social conservatives, like a formulation that women who had abortions should be punished, bore all the hallmarks of a candidate who was overcompensating. Cruz, the conservative Texas Republican and a rival of Trump's for the nomination, criticized him harshly for that statement, contending that Trump hasn't seriously thought through the issues. Trump's campaign appeared to have other fundamental flaws, particularly when it came to fundraising. The billionaire businessman had only raised $3.1 million in May, typical of a rainmaking Senate candidate, not one running for president. By every traditional metric, his campaign was insufficient to win a primary, much less a general election. Despite all that, Trump's ascent in the Republican primary had been a pretty straight line, and by May 23rd, he led Hillary by 0.2 percentage point. Once he captured the nomination, Republican voters began flocking to him. In the final stages of the primary season, it was Trump who was gaining strength for the general election. From the White House, Obama chose to remain neutral in the primary. Early on, it made sense for him to stay above the fray of an intra-party contest. As the calendar wound down, there was a risk that weighing in would backfire, bolstering Bernie's claims that the Democratic Party had rigged the nomination process for Hillary. Obama could end up alienating Bernie supporters in his own coalition and re-energizing their complaints against Hillary. So it wasn't until about a week or so before the June 7th California primary that Obama gave White House officials the nod to begin putting together a plan for the president to endorse Hillary in a video, a piece of shareable content that could bounce around and through the Warrens of the Internet and reach every last voter who was interested in watching it. Over the weekend before the primary, aides arranged for Obama to speak to Bernie from a fundraising and golfing trip in Florida. When they connected by phone, Obama congratulated Bernie on running a tough campaign. "But it's the end of the road," Obama told his former Senate colleague. "It's time to unify the party." "And," the president added, "I'm going to endorse Hillary after California." As leader of the party, it was Obama's place, and only Obama's place, to tell a Democratic presidential candidate when to exit the race with grace. That's what he was doing now. Bernie got it. "I appreciate your neutrality through the primary," he replied, adding a small request. "Let me come to the Oval Office for a meeting before you endorse her." Obama agreed. On June 7th, while California voters were still at the polls, Obama walked down the majestic colonnade near the Rose Garden and into the White House residence to put the finishing touches on an unspoken pact he'd made with Hillary the day he'd asked her to serve as his Secretary of State. They had become close enough personally not to think of his endorsement of her in the transactional terms of a final payment on the deal. But that's what it was. One of the last big, mutually beneficial acts of a political partnership for the ages. For Hillary, who was eager to have Obama on her side as soon as possible, and who would have liked an endorsement before the primaries began, it was the validation she'd been waiting on. For Obama, it was the ultimate insurance policy on his legacy. He settled into a wood-backed chair in front of a red-patterned sofa in the map room. Oddly enough, the same room in which Bill Clinton had given grand jury testimony during the Monica Lewinsky scandal. By recording a video in the residence, Obama was able to keep his endorsement under wraps. As the president prepared himself, he thought of the journey he and Hillary had undertaken at the highest levels of policy and politics. The 2008 primary, the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, her quiet assistance in passing his health care law, and the many stops where they'd shared exhausted laughs as they tried to leverage American power around the globe. With the camera rolling, Obama testified to Hillary's judgment, celebrated the history she was making, and urged his supporters to build the rest of his blueprint by electing his former rival president. "I don't think there's ever been someone so qualified to hold this office," he said in the relaxed, confident, and upbeat tone Americans had become familiar with over the previous decade. "I want those of you who have been with me since the beginning of this incredible journey to be the first to know that I'm with her." With the film in the proverbial can, the only question for the White House was timing its release. But that process ended up being driven not by Obama or Hillary, but by Sanders, who wanted his Oval Office meeting before Obama signaled the end of the primary campaign. That was very important to Bernie, and because Hillary wanted to smooth the path for him and his followers to unite with her, it was important to her. And because it was important to Hillary, it was important to the White House. In addition, the president admired the way Sanders had mobilized the progressive grassroots and didn't mind doing Sanders the small courtesy of waiting a couple of days to put the exclamation point on Hillary's victory. Beating expectations, she won California on the night of Obama's video shoot by about 7 points and also picked up New Jersey, New Mexico, and South Dakota. Hillary had gone home to New York to address her supporters. For most nominees, the victory speech at the end of the primaries is the time to honor defeated rivals, start to bring the party together, and punch the other side's candidate. Hillary's team had written all of those themes into her remarks at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. There was also a nod to the history she and her voters had made. But it wasn't enough for Hillary. Just before she took the stage, she told Dan Schwerin she wanted her words to be big enough for the moment. "Put in brackets, Seneca Falls," she said. Hillary didn't need a script to riff on the famous Women's Rights Conference. After acknowledging the milestone of becoming the first woman to win a major party presidential primary, she said the victory belonged to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed. "In our country, it started right here in New York, a place called Seneca Falls, in 1848, when a small but determined group of women and men came together with the idea that women deserved equal rights, and they set it forth in something called the Declaration of Sentiments, and it was the first time in human history that that kind of declaration occurred. So we all owe so much to those who came before, and tonight belongs to all of you." Hillary hoped to make more history before all was said and done, and yet she recognized the importance of pausing to call attention to the progress that she and the nation had made. But Bernie, speaking that same night in California, still wasn't ready to release his supporters from the thrall of the campaign. "I am pretty good at arithmetic, and I know that the fight in front of us is a very, very steep fight," he said. "But we will continue to fight for every vote and every delegate we can get." Even when the primary calendar had come to a close with Hillary holding an insurmountable number of delegates, she couldn't have one night of relief from the battle. At some point during the campaign, Jennifer Palmieri, the communications director, had coined a phrase to describe the punishing pattern in which there never seemed to be an unadulterated triumph. "We are not allowed to have nice things," she'd said. The interminable fight with Bernie, in the midst of Trump gathering his party, certainly qualified. But the pattern would soon repeat in an unpredictable and unfathomable fashion. When Bernie returned to Vermont after the June 7th primaries, he huddled with Jane, Jeff Weaver, and Tad Devine. "The race is over," Devine told Bernie. "This thing with Trump is very serious. It's not going to be a blowout. The sooner you can put it together, the better. Call her. Tell her how important it is to win the election and that you'll do whatever she needs you to do to win." But Bernie didn't want to give up the leverage created by the number of votes and delegates he'd won. As soon as he conceded the political battle to Hillary, he'd have no way to force substantive concessions from her in the formation of the party's platform. He was committed to making his political revolution mean something. "If I don't get what I need," he told Devine, "I'm going to have to negotiate harder." Jane and Weaver stood with him. Devine left town. Sanders ended up in the West Wing of the White House on the morning of June 9th, 2 days after the California primary. He knew that an endorsement of Hillary was coming, but he didn't know when it would come or how, just that it would be after he left. Obama started to soften the blow for Bernie by talking about the parallels between their campaigns and their visions for the country. In the sense that they both ran outsider campaigns built on the promise of reforming Washington, Bernie and Obama had something in common. But comparisons with Bernie irritated Obama no end, and he could be heard grumbling about them in the West Wing. "No serious person would really compare me to Bernie," Obama thought, and hoped. It probably wouldn't have bugged him so much if there wasn't at least a kernel of truth to the idea. But he believed it was a fundamentally unfair comparison. He thought he'd put meat on the bones of his own proposals in 2008, and that Bernie had not done the same in 2016. Bernie might be able to hit a high note or two, but he couldn't sustain a melody. Whenever the subject came up privately, Obama would talk about his respect for what Bernie had done to make it a race against Hillary, but he seldom failed to let his annoyance show. For Bernie's visit, he was going to have to hold it back. Obama told Sanders that he'd been impressed with the Vermont senator's energy and his ability to tap into compelling arguments that resonated with voters. More important, the president said, he didn't want Democrats to lose what Bernie had brought to the table, and not just because he wanted Hillary to win. Obama and Sanders shared a capacity to bring more people into the political system. The two men spent some of their hour-long meeting brainstorming ways that the Democratic Party could sustain the energy of Bernie's campaign, both in the election and in helping to move public policy debates with grassroots engagement. Though he'd tried with a group called Organizing for America, Obama had been unsuccessful at converting his campaign into a non-election year force in public policy. Bernie had a chance to use his own movement to affect policy. Bernie's reservations about aspects of the administration notwithstanding, he'd always admired Obama's cool handling of crises. It was a trait that eluded Bernie at times. He got fired up too easily over little things. Indeed, the rigors and stresses of the campaign trail put Obama's skills into sharper relief for him. Now Bernie knew firsthand how hard it was to project composure on the big stage of national politics, where scrutiny from an opponent and the media exaggerated every Brooklyn-accented word and every finger jabbed in the air to emphasize a point. Obama made it look so damn easy. Following the one-on-one with the president, Sanders held an ad hoc press conference in the driveway outside the West Wing. The campaign that had begun in the Senate swamp 14 months earlier was ending, as Bernie had hoped, at the White House. But, despite his best efforts, it was coming to a close on the wrong side of the doors. He still wasn't quite ready to say anything close to, I'm with her. I look forward to meeting with her in the near future to see how we can work together to defeat Donald Trump and to create a government which represents all of us and not just the 1%, Sanders said. White House officials didn't give the media time to dissect what Sanders had said or to report that his "the enemy of my enemy is my friend" acknowledgement of his preference fell short of the kind of endorsement Hillary would have liked. Bernie was hardly out of the driveway when they pushed out Obama's endorsement video, wiping out what had been the big story of the morning, the Democratic Party's effort to bring Sanders inside the Clinton tent. Instead, all of the headlines pointed to Obama's endorsement of Clinton and their upcoming joint appearance in Wisconsin that had just been announced. On the one hand, it was a great day for Hillary. Bernie had gotten out of the race, and Obama had endorsed her. But it was telling that the White House had needed to step on Bernie's departure to quell news stories about the deep divisions that remained in the party. White House officials and Clinton campaign aides had settled on Green Bay, Wisconsin for the president's first joint appearance with Hillary. The location had been selected in part by process of elimination. Mook wanted Obama to go to North Carolina to rally Democrats, but the White House didn't want to get in the middle of the fight over the state's bathroom bill. Pennsylvania and Michigan were out because Mook was reluctant to give Trump a reason to think Hillary was worried about those states. They settled on Wisconsin, but Mook wasn't a fan of going to Green Bay. The voters there wanted change, and Obama's presence would suggest that Hillary was running for his third term, he thought. Mook argued that it was better to send Obama to a place where he could mobilize millennials and register African-American voters. But there were reasons to think that Green Bay was exactly the kind of place where Hillary should be campaigning, with or without Obama. The National Football League's poster town for hard-scrabble working-class values, the city and surrounding Brown County were chock-full of the very working-class white voters who had supported Obama in 2008, were deeply ambivalent about Hillary, and were open to the siren song of Trump's promise to restore American greatness. It was a part of the country that was competitive, but trending in the wrong direction for Democrats. In Brown County, Obama had won with 54% of the vote in 2008 and then lost with 48% in 2012. It was the kind of national bellwether county where Democrats couldn't afford to cede much more ground if Hillary hoped to win the presidency. But she and Obama never made it there. 3 days before they were set to visit, a 29-year-old security guard killed 49 people at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, in a lone wolf attack. The shooter had placed a call to police beforehand in which he swore allegiance to ISIS, the terrorist group wreaking havoc across Syria and Iraq. Rather than shrouding the nation in solemnity, the specter of a heavily armed Muslim man opening fire with an assault weapon in a gay club created a political firestorm. Trump charged in a statement that Obama should resign and Hillary should bow out of the race if they refused to say the words radical Islamic terrorism. He reiterated his call for a ban on admitting Muslims to the United States and boasted of his prescience in predicting that there would be another mass killing in America. "Because our leaders are weak, I said this was going to happen, and it is only going to get worse," Trump said. Hillary and Obama called off their rally in Green Bay, postponing their first big event until a more appropriate time. A big moment was again being stolen by events outside her control. Their staffs went back to the drawing board and, at the end of June, settled on a familiar setting. Charlotte, North Carolina, had played host to the 2012 Democratic National Convention, where Bill Clinton delivered a magnum opus that even many Obama loyalists considered the defining speech of the president's re-election campaign. foregoing Wisconsin, widely perceived as home turf for Democrats, they decided to go into tougher territory to try to expand the electoral map. "We agreed that North Carolina would be a good on-offense trip to do," said one official involved in the planning. The shift was evidence of the Clinton camp's growing confidence. On June 27th, as the White House and Brooklyn were putting the finishing touches on the plan for the trip, the administration and the Clinton campaign collided, metaphorically, on a tarmac in Phoenix, Arizona. Bill Clinton was in one plane when he found out that Attorney General Loretta Lynch was sitting in another plane at the same airport. He walked over for a visit with the official who held authority over whether Hillary would be charged in the email scandal. Lynch felt that she couldn't refuse a quick greeting from Bill, a former president. He had picked her to serve as the United States Attorney for the Eastern District of New York in 1999, a job that had helped catapult her through the prosecutorial ranks and eventually into the role of the nation's chief law enforcement officer. But this discussion was more than a quick hello. It went on for 30 minutes. She would later say they talked about their families, golf, travel, and Bill's favorite topic of the moment, Brexit. Bill didn't have to say anything about Hillary's email case for the meeting to create havoc. It could be read as a message to Lynch that she'd better not charge Hillary if she expected to keep her job, or as a sign to the public that Lynch had already decided not to prosecute. Clinton critics said it could have a chilling effect on the FBI, which was still investigating Hillary, or Justice Department officials involved in the prosecution decision. The ex parte chat set off a flurry of punditry and headlines questioning Lynch's impartiality. It also reinforced the idea that Hillary could pull establishment strings to rig outcomes in her favor. Lynch backed off as if scalded by a hot stove, publicly stating that she would follow the recommendation of the FBI and the career lawyers at the Justice Department on the Clinton email probe. She never went so far as to say that she would give up her right to intervene if she didn't agree with the FBI's recommendation on whether or not to prosecute. But FBI Director James Comey would soon seize on Lynch's quasi-recusal to step into the spotlight. West Wing and Clinton campaign aides had the same collective reaction to the meeting, according to one Democratic source who talked to officials in both places. What the fuck? Bill Clinton didn't have an impulse control button. Everyone knew that. And still, this stood out as colossally high risk and low reward. Hillary's aides would insist that he was just being friendly and cordial. It was plausible that Bill hadn't even thought of the email investigation, one campaign official said, because the Clintons and their aides never took seriously the possibility that she could be charged with a crime. "We always thought it was a joke," the aide said. The White House didn't think it was funny. Obama and his aides knew they couldn't account for Bill Clinton's behavior, but they were dismayed with Lynch. She had a well-earned reputation as one of the shrewdest and most mistake-averse members of his team. The tarmac debacle couldn't have happened at a worse time. Less than a week before Obama's first stump speech for Hillary, conservatives were charging that his Justice Department was on the verge of letting her off the hook on the email scandal. They had pretty good circumstantial evidence that the Obama Justice Department and the Clinton operation were coordinating on the email scandal. Even if it wasn't true, and both sides insisted it wasn't, how could anyone be certain? For Comey, a former federal prosecutor who had been the deputy attorney general during President George W. Bush's administration, the flow of events created an opportunity to play the roles of FBI director and attorney general at the same time. On July 5th, the very day Obama and Hillary were scheduled to fly to Charlotte for their first joint event, Comey stepped to a podium at the J. Edgar Hoover Building in Washington. Wearing a gold tie pinched tight at the knot and standing in front of two Justice Department banners and an American flag, the FBI director began reading an indictment of Hillary Clinton's conduct. She and her aides were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information. It was possible, he said, that hostile actors gained access to her emails, including those containing sensitive information. And, he added, it was possible that she had broken the law. But, he said, the Justice Department had never prosecuted someone under similar circumstances before. He would recommend against filing charges in the case. It was highly unusual, if not unprecedented, for the FBI director to read out the findings of an investigation when the target wouldn't be charged. The email scandal was over, and everyone was unhappy with the outcome. Conservatives looked past Comey's public shaming of Hillary and faulted him for letting her off the hook. Liberals were furious that he'd paired his recommendation against prosecution with a stinging rebuke of Hillary's character and judgment. While Comey was delivering his verdict, Hillary was giving a speech less than a mile away at the National Education Association's representative assembly at the Walter E. Washington Convention Center. Backstage, her aides hopped onto a conference call with her lawyers that would last for 45 minutes. Members of her press staff fielded what one insider called relentless fuck yous from reporters who believed they'd been lied to about how she'd handled her email as Secretary of State. It was hard to keep track of how many times Hillary and her press team had said things on the record that were contradicted, either directly or by implication, in Comey's statement about why a case was not moving forward. At the end of the NEA event, Hillary slid into an SUV with John Podesta, Huma Abedin, and Jake Sullivan. As her motorcade navigated through the city toward Joint Base Andrews, the suburban Maryland military installation where Air Force One sat waiting to take her and Obama to Charlotte, Hillary processed what Comey had done. While it was a relief to be in the clear, the outcome she'd always expected, it was infuriating to be subjected to Comey's clear attempt to explain himself to the public and to Republicans in Congress by whacking her. Hillary's goal was to starve, not feed, a media frenzy that threatened to distract from Obama's first campaign appearance for her. Attacking Comey directly was out of the question. Though he was a Republican, no one in Washington had a better reputation for executing his or her duties without fear or favor. Obama had picked him to run the FBI, even though he had been a high-ranking political appointee in President George W. Bush's Justice Department. She and her aides knew that she'd lose in the court of public opinion if she got in a fight with the highly regarded and widely respected FBI director. So her campaign spokesman, Brian Fallon, a former Justice Department official, issued the most vanilla statement he could possibly serve up. "We are pleased that the career officials handling this case have determined that no further action by the department is appropriate," he said. "As the secretary has long said, it was a mistake to use her personal email, and she would not do it again. We are glad that this matter is now resolved." It didn't address any of Comey's allegations of carelessness, evasion of open records rules, and possible exposure of government secrets to America's enemies. It can be hard to fully appreciate just how much Hillary could have been buffeted by the events of that early July day. Comey's statement in and of itself was a heavily stirred good news, bad news cocktail of reprieve and reproof that bolstered her legal case while laying bare the lies of her political spin. She didn't have much time to sort through all that before the most important stop of her campaign to date, a debut appearance with Obama that she saw as a crucial piece of her effort to begin the post-primary unification of a still fractured Democratic Party. Inside the Clinton campaign and at the White House, there were two basic reads on the awkward timing of Comey's making his statement just hours before the Charlotte campaign stop. One, it ensured that Obama's first appearance for Clinton wouldn't monopolize newscasts and headlines. And two, by juxtaposing the two news-driving events, the attention paid to the one-time rivals appearing together again on a campaign stage would dampen the impact of Comey's statement. For the day of news coverage, would it have been more ideal had that not been yesterday? One Obama World source asked rhetorically the next day. Yeah, because it would have been about the president and Clinton campaigning together, instead of it being 400 malice pieces about what Comey said. But, this official said, if you were to pick between either that or in a week her being indicted, yeah, we'd go with that. Still, the inescapable doom that shadowed Hillary's campaign had reared its head again. On the day Obama would endorse her, and at the same time she was being let off the legal hook for her email scandal, the FBI director affirmed she'd done something wrong, just nothing he could pin on her. Hillary's small procession of SUVs pulled up at Andrews at 12:35 p.m., 45 minutes before Obama's scheduled arrival and the near-immediate departure of Air Force One. She and her aides boarded the bird and waited for Obama in the plane's senior staff cabin. Comey was still on her mind. "She's frustrated because it dropped like a hammer," said one of her senior staff members. "She was digesting the news and inscrutable," said another aide. When the commander-in-chief bounded into the cabin and plopped down into one of the four facing leather captain's chairs, Hillary was still quietly cursing Comey. But Obama helped turn her mood around. He was relaxed and excited about the chance to deliver a campaign-style ass-kicking to Trump. His energy was infectious, helping Hillary shove Comey to the back burner. It wasn't the first time she'd had to compartmentalize bad news and push through it with a happy face. "It wasn't a given that we were able to bifurcate these two things," said one Hillary aide. "But the president was so happy." On the quick hop to North Carolina, less than an hour in the air, Hillary showed Obama pictures of her grandchildren, Charlotte and Aiden, and they discussed their shared chagrin about Trump's ability to foment anger in the electorate. But there was meat to their discussion, too. With White House Communications Director Jen Psaki and Huma Abedin floating in and out of the small cabin on Air Force One, Obama, Hillary, Sullivan, Podesta, and White House Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes dissected the president's policy in the Middle East. Obama quizzed Hillary on her take on Syria in particular. In a break with the president, she had recommended implementing a no-fly zone to try to protect innocents from the wrath of President Bashar al-Assad. One participant likened the rhythm and substance to the kind of conversation Obama would have had with a columnist who had a different point of view. He wanted to know whether she thought it would really make sense to threaten Syrian regime assets in order to force a negotiation, for example. The contrast in their positions was almost as dramatic a departure as you will see in the national security space among two people in the same party, the participant said. They also discussed how Hillary would continue to implement the Iran nuclear deal that her aides had first negotiated, and talked a bit about Asia. Anything to avoid the Comey elephant in the room. At one point, Obama took on the role of pep-talking coach, dispensing a little bit of wisdom to the woman he defeated on his way to the presidency. "It's a 4-month sprint to the end, and it will go quickly," he said, betraying a hint of nostalgia. "It's hard and it's tiring, but this is a different stage than the primary." The email scandal and Comey's just-delivered indictment of Clinton's behavior could have occupied half of Air Force One, but they were unwelcome visitors. Obama had been briefed on the Comey statement, seemingly just the latest turn in an unfolding story he'd kept up with from the Oval Office. And of course, he'd been asked about the email issue more times than he would have liked. Publicly, he towed the company line and said he knew Hillary wouldn't intentionally mishandle information, and he believed that. But inside the secluded confines of the West Wing, he confided his true feelings. He couldn't understand what possessed Hillary to set up the private email server, and her handling of the scandal, obfuscate, deny, and evade, amounted to political malpractice. He wanted his friend to win, and yet she was exhibiting, again, some of the very qualities that had helped him defeat her in 2008. It was a classic, unforced Clinton error, and he couldn't believe that she and the people around her had let it happen. When would they learn? He said nothing of this to Hillary. When he scratched his head or rolled his eyes, he did it in the privacy of the West Wing. When Obama and Clinton arrived at the rally, two seemingly conflicting dynamics took hold. Comey dominated news coverage, and Clinton and Obama effectively communicated to Democrats and independents that she would be leading a unified party into battle in November. Comey distracted from the message Hillary and Obama tried to send, but he didn't prevent it from getting out. Obama was thrilled to take on Trump, but he was also getting his first chance to really lay out his argument for why Hillary Clinton should succeed him. The night before, he had studied drafts of the speech to ensure he got the tone just right. Both Obama and Hillary knew that his power as an advocate for her lay in his knowledge of the job she sought and in his own personal approval ratings. Where she was seen as dishonest, he had much more credibility with the public and nearly universal trust within the Democratic Party. His job was to talk about her credentials, temperament, and credibility, and she sorely needed a character witness on that latter trait. He could speak to Clinton's character in moments when the public couldn't see what she was doing. With his legacy in mind, Obama told the crowd in Charlotte that he was ready to pass the baton to a fuchsia-suited Clinton who sat behind him on a stool and nodded approvingly throughout a partially improvised speech that lasted more than 40 minutes. It was the wording of his testament to her that he had played with at the White House the night before. "I saw how she treated everybody with respect, even the folks who aren't, quote, unquote, important. That's how you judge somebody. How do they treat somebody when the cameras are off and they can't do anything for you?" he said. "Do you still treat them right? Do you still treat them with respect? Do you still listen to them? Are you still fighting for them?" For a candidate beset by the perception that she was operating dishonestly in the shadows, it was an important validation of her values. But the speech would be remembered for Obama's off-the-teleprompter riffs on Trump. He liked to needle the Donald, almost as much as he liked firing up a big crowd. This moment gave him the opportunity to do both. "Everybody can tweet, but nobody actually knows what it takes to do the job until you sit behind the desk," Obama chided as the crowd cheered. "I mean, Sasha tweets, but she doesn't think that she thereby should be sitting behind the desk." Obama was feeling it, and because he was feeling it, so was Hillary. For a couple of hours, at least, James Comey faded into the background. On a rope line after their speeches, Obama and Hillary put their arms around each other's waists and whispered to each other as they greeted voters. Afterward, in a holding area, Obama walked up to Podesta and Sullivan, both of whom had worked at the White House in his administration. "This is too easy," Obama said, flashing a toothy grin. Podesta looked up at his former boss quizzically. "Are you fucking kidding me?" "All right, all right, all right," Obama conceded. There's just so much material. Chapter 14. Hillary just can't make up her mind. Hillary was dissatisfied with her options. She wanted a vice presidential running mate who would electrify her campaign. It was late June or early July when one of her senior aides described her conundrum. Hillary just can't make up her mind. She doesn't have a good list. And that's how Elizabeth Warren made an 11th-hour climb up the ranks of Hillary's shortlist. The Massachusetts senator, a liberal darling, Trump antagonist, and unrelenting populist, who had won her Senate seat in a state full of working-class whites, had the potential to mainline progressive enthusiasm into Hillary's ticket. And she would reinforce the history-making aspect of Hillary's narrative if America elected not one, but two women to executive office in the same year. Warren had precisely the sizzle Hillary was looking for to juice up the campaign, but Clinton wanted a governing partner, someone who saw the world in a similar way and could help her run the executive branch. She just didn't know if she could trust Warren to be pragmatic and constructive. The decision would pit Hillary's natural caution, focus on policymaking, and thirst for loyalty against her desire to give her ticket fresh appeal. That Hillary would even consider Warren, who had pilloried her for flip-flopping to vote in favor of a bankruptcy reform bill, stunned some denizens of Clinton world. For most of the campaign, Hillary's aides had frantically exchanged concerns that Warren would endorse Sanders, an ideological brother. Huma Abedin, in particular, was obsessed with the idea that Warren was always on the verge of backing Bernie, an anxiety that may have reflected Hillary's own worry. But throughout, Warren maintained studied neutrality, even as she pushed Hillary to the left publicly and privately via mutual friends Gary Gensler, a former Commodity Futures Trading Commission chairman and the campaign's chief financial officer, and Mandy Grunwald. As the primary drew closer to its end, the fiery, populist, former Harvard professor tangled with Trump in speeches and on Twitter. Warren respected Hillary and appreciated her ability to work with colleagues to get things done. Hillary began, for the first time, to see Warren as a pragmatist with a steely backbone. She liked what she saw. Both women recognized that their commonalities far outweighed their differences. Hillary also knew that Warren had been back-channeling with her policy aides since the beginning of the campaign. The open line, usually Gensler's cell phone, enabled Warren to make her views known before planks of the platform were rolled out and allowed the campaign to avoid surprising a potential ally. Liberals had initially begged Warren to jump into the primary, labeling themselves members of the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party. She had declined, but retained a hold on the party's economic progressives, a set that was disappointed in Hillary even when she moved toward them. There was no question that Hillary would please the Democratic base if she picked Warren. Hillary invited Warren to a meeting at the Clinton family home on Whitehaven Street in the nation's capital on the morning of June 10th. Warren issued an endorsement of Hillary the night before their sit-down, clearing the way for a more serious discussion. Their chat catapulted Warren into real consideration, said one high-ranking Clinton campaign official. They connected at a policy level, said a second official familiar with the conversation. They like to get into the details. Hillary decided from that meeting and an earlier joint rally that Warren was someone who should advance into the final round of consideration. It gave Hillary comfort that was a choice that should really be seen from all sides and that she can move forward, the second official said. Inside the campaign, some of the younger aides were pulling for Warren, and Brooklyn fielded plenty of testimonials from progressive groups and Bernie supporters. If it wasn't going to be Bernie, and it wasn't, selecting Warren would show that Hillary had learned from the primary that she needed to address the populist clamor within the party. Some of the veteran hands in Brooklyn worried that two women would be too much for voters. That wasn't the deciding factor for Hillary, though. Ultimately, Hillary hadn't been through enough political transactions with Warren to feel comfortable that they would be a good match. After all, Obama had become deeply frustrated with Warren, a one-time ally, for what he saw as demagoguing against him on economic issues and for wreaking havoc when he nominated a banker, Antonio Weiss, as an undersecretary at the Treasury Department. "It's safe to say she's not a favorite person in this building," one White House official observed. Throughout the selection process, Hillary picked the brains of a close circle of aides, as well as other Democratic officials. She'd ask what they thought, but played her hand very close to the vest. Bill Clinton, who was once reported to favor Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, told Podesta at one point that it was Hillary's choice to make. Podesta, the founder of the liberal think tank Center for American Progress, favored a Kennedy-Johnson-style pick of a progressive to balance the ticket, though not necessarily Warren. And he, too, was careful not to push his preferences on Hillary. Another potential candidate who had surfaced during the selection process, largely under the radar, was Joe Biden. The vice president's name was tossed around by members of Congress and some top Hillary aides. Sullivan, who served as Biden's national security advisor before ultimately returning to work on Clinton's campaign, was particularly intrigued by the idea. "No constitutional bar to it, so why would you take it off the table?" one Hillary advisor reasoned. Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill provided a light push for Biden from Capitol Hill, but the suggestion was never taken very seriously by the campaign. Hillary didn't want or need the vice president, who had flirted with running long enough and said enough unflattering things about her to injure her when Bernie Sanders' campaign was gaining steam in the latter part of 2015. Barack Obama might be able to count Biden as an unfailing loyalist, but Hillary never would. And nothing would have screamed status quo louder than keeping Obama's vice president in his job. Throughout the process, Podesta demanded secrecy. A small group of senior aides met frequently in the Brooklyn headquarters to discuss Hillary's options. Everyone in the office knew what they were talking about, but little leaked. Podesta even sent an email to those involved in the process warning them not to talk to the media about the deliberations. Some of the candidates made joint appearances with Hillary on the campaign trail so she could assess their skills in person, and others, like Secretary of Labor Tom Perez, had auditions with Bill, who gave his opinions freely to his wife. Perez didn't make the cut. By mid-July, it was basically down to Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, Vilsack, and Warren. Vilsack was milquetoast. Booker, the only minority to make the final cut, was seen as a future star, but he didn't have much history with Hillary, and the campaign's consensus was that she didn't need an African-American running mate. And she didn't know much about Kaine, other than the fact that he'd endorsed Obama out of the box in 2007. Sherrod Brown, an Ohio senator who could rally party populists and with whom Hillary always had a strong personal bond, had a cheering section within the campaign and among some of Hillary's outside advisors. But he also carried a unique disadvantage. If he was picked and Hillary won, the state's Republican governor, John Kasich, would get to choose his replacement in the Senate. While Massachusetts also had a Republican governor, state law called for a quick special election, and Democrats weren't terribly worried about holding Warren's seat. but they were concerned that a Republican could win and keep the seat for a long time in Ohio if Brown were no longer there to defend it. Obama had told Hillary that he liked Kaine, and the Virginia senator's selection would allow a pal, Governor Terry McAuliffe, to appoint a replacement to the Senate. Kaine was also the only one with a resume that boasted both domestic and foreign policy experience. He was a former governor of Virginia and a member of the Senate Armed Services and Foreign Relations Committees. But Hillary hardly knew Kaine, a real consideration for her, and the public perception of him, to the extent there was one, was that he was as dull as a month-old razor. Still, Kaine, the man political handicappers had identified early as the likeliest pick, had emerged as the leading contender by Thursday, July 21st. He filled the most boxes on her checklist of considerations. "The fix wasn't in for Tim Kaine," said one of the advisors who participated in the vetting process, "but he was always the front runner. Kaine didn't give her a state she couldn't win on her own, add populist progressive flavor to the ticket, or excite anyone, including the candidate herself. Instead, she'd worked through a process of elimination, even as she'd complained that her options were suboptimal. The bench was thin, in part because Hillary herself, one half of the Clinton political empire, had been a candidate, or potential candidate, since the 2004 election cycle. Kaine was someone she didn't know well, but felt a very strong rapport with once the four of them, the Clintons and the Kaines, really started to get together. Liked his values, similar stories, reinforced each other's stories," said one of the people familiar with her decision-making. She felt, on balance, that Tim would be a very solid person on the campaign trail, would be a really good partner. But even after settling on Kaine, Hillary wasn't quite ready to pull the trigger until the afternoon of Friday, July 22nd, the day before a planned rollout event with the VP pick in South Florida, and 3 days before the start of the Democratic convention. She'd waited until the last possible minute to tap her running mate. While campaigning in Florida that afternoon, she called Podesta at the Brooklyn headquarters. "I feel confident about this decision," she told him. "Let's put it in motion." Podesta had to move fast. Once he got off the phone, he executed a black ops mission to grab the Virginia senator surreptitiously, sequester him from the view of the media, and get him ready for the next day's rollout. His chief of staff, Sarah Latham, gave the high sign to speechwriter Megan Rooney and former Iowa State Director Matt Paul, who had been tapped to work for the vice presidential nominee. Rooney and her colleagues had prepared speech drafts with personal details for Kaine, Vilsack, Booker, and Warren. They also had biographical sketches on hand for several other candidates in case Hillary had chosen a wild card. Before leaving, Rooney wrote out a list of speeches for her team to have ready, with TK in the number one position. Then Podesta, Latham, Rooney, and Paul headed to a back elevator to ride down to the garage. When they got there, a black Suburban was waiting with the doors open. It took them to the airport in Teterboro, New Jersey, where they boarded a private jet for a flight to Quonset State Airport in North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Once they landed, a flight attendant was dispatched to acquire a bottle of champagne as Podesta and Latham sped off in an SUV to meet Kaine, who still didn't know he'd been picked. The Virginia senator was in Rhode Island to headline a fundraiser for Senator Jack Reed, a fellow member of the Armed Services Committee, at the Newport Shipyard, and Podesta and Latham pulled up outside the event. From there, Podesta dialed several of the also-rans to inform them they wouldn't be on the ticket. Hillary was doing the same thing from Miami. When the call lists were exhausted, she dialed Kaine. Inside the event, Kane's phone rang. He answered and heard Hillary on the line. Seeking privacy for the call, Kane ducked into an empty office. With dock workers trying to gain access to the space, Kane spent 15 to 20 minutes on the phone with Hillary, who secured his commitment to run and advised him of one more important logistical detail. "I don't mean to alarm you," she said, "but John Podesta is outside your building right now." The campaign chairman, still undetected by the media, would drive Kane away from the fundraiser. Podesta then called Kane, who said he wanted to go back to his nearby hotel and tell his wife, Ann Holton. "Give me 5 minutes," Kane said. Getting into a Volvo, which would attract less attention than the SUV, Podesta drove Kane to the hotel. The new VP candidate went upstairs to talk with his wife, and then Podesta, Latham, and Kane aides Mike Henry and Amy Dudley joined them. Podesta sat on the bed and went over the plans for the next 24 hours. While they were there, Obama congratulated Kane by phone. Having been the runner-up to Biden in Obama's VP selection process in 2008, Kane had never allowed himself to get overexcited at the prospect of joining Hillary's ticket. Now, though, he was suddenly full of energy. "He was juiced," said one of the people in the room. The small party headed back to the airport for the flight to Miami. When they pulled up, Rooney and Paul were waiting by the staircase to a second jet. The whole process of calling the also-rans and gathering Kane had taken so long that Hillary's longtime scheduler, Lona Valmoro, had to arrange for a new plane because the flight crew for the first one had worked too many hours to make the trip. As lightning lit up the night sky, the Canes, Podesta, and the small cluster of aides boarded the plane. His and hers Hillary Clinton for President swag bags, one with a blue strap and the other with a red strap, sat waiting in the Canes' seats. With the champagne ready to flow, Holton interrupted. "I know someone who would prefer bourbon," she said of her husband. So they toasted with a small bottle of Maker's Mark. The official announcement of her vice presidential running mate was one of the days on the calendar that Hillary should have been able to count on as a Yale lock for excitement, enthusiasm, energy, and relentlessly positive press coverage. Instead, as she made her way toward Florida International University in Miami, for what should have been a squeaky clean event, more controversy was brewing. Hillary was in danger of getting drowned out by her own party's blemished national chairwoman, Debbie Wasserman Schultz. The South Florida congresswoman, a Queens export who lived in the gated community haven of western Broward County, was impossible to miss sitting in a spacious backstage holding room at FIU. Aside from the signature heap of dyed, dirty blonde curls that called attention to her even on the very rare occasions when she wanted to fade into the walls, Wasserman Schultz was throwing a full-on fit. This was supposed to be a big moment for DWS, too. It had been circled on her calendar as the day that Hillary would sweep into her home district and say kind words about her, which wouldn't have mattered so much in a year in which Bernie Sanders hadn't encouraged his supporters to fund her primary opponent's campaign. But Wasserman Schultz was now at the center of the internecine Democratic war over the presidential primary. The day before this Saturday rollout, WikiLeaks had released a trove of damaging internal DNC emails that suggested anti-Bernie bias on the part of Wasserman Schultz and her aides. A cyber attacker, going by the alias Guccifer 2.0, a name that would crop up again later in the campaign, claimed credit for swiping the emails and giving them to WikiLeaks. They had been published just before the Kane event and a few days before the start of the party's convention. It didn't take a political pro to know that the leak was designed to sow dissent within the party, just as Hillary was trying to bring Democrats together. As a bonus for the GOP, Many voters wouldn't make a distinction between headlines about the DNC emails and those about Hillary's private email server, even though they were totally unrelated. On one level, it shouldn't have been surprising if the official political arm of the Democratic Party was more supportive of Hillary against an outsider who was reluctant to even run as a member of the party. On another, though, it was proof positive to Sanders' supporters and to Clinton's critics inside and outside the Democratic Party that Hillary was an establishment creature who rigged political outcomes. Operating in the shadows, Washington insiders like Wasserman Schultz were working to frustrate the will of the people, and they had been caught red-handed. At least, that's how the Bernie crowd saw things. Wasserman Schultz had become the face of Sanders' argument that the entire party had manipulated the outcome for Hillary. In fact, there was no more controversial figure in the party at that exact moment than the DNC chair, who had just become exponentially more toxic. Hillary needed to focus on reaching out to the Democratic base, not repelling it. This was always supposed to be the day that she introduced her running mate to the public. Now, during one of her campaign's most important hours, she had to answer the looming question for all the Bernie skeptics about how she would treat the local congresswoman amid the rapidly unfolding DNC email scandal. The answer in Brooklyn was simple. They wanted to keep Wasserman Schultz as far away from Hillary as possible. As much as Sanders saw Wasserman Schultz as a semi-secret agent for Hillary, the Clinton campaign didn't like the DNC chairwoman much either. Hillary genuinely likes Debbie. I think she's the only one in the orbit who does, one Democratic source said early on. The campaign does not like Debbie. Part of that disdain stemmed from Wasserman Schultz's tendency to make decisions without the input of the campaign, like when she hired the party convention CEO, Leah Daughtry, without consulting Mook or the candidate. Mook characterized himself as distressed and dumbfounded over this lack of coordination and told Podesta that they may need to sit down with Debbie to make clear how we want things to change, improve, before we are willing to consider playing ball with them. He told Hillary he would keep his mouth shut until she had a chance to talk to Wasserman Schultz, but noted that this concerns me a lot. Hillary's hair was considerably less aflame. I just talked to her and she told me she had hired Leah after an exhaustive interviewing process, Hillary reported back to Mook and Podesta. But Hillary's top two aides would keep Wasserman Schultz in their crosshairs. Later, in 2015, Mook presented Hillary with options for taking operational control of the DNC, at least one of which included replacing Wasserman Schultz. Hillary didn't bite then or later when Podesta made similar entreaties to find a new chair. She felt loyal to her, one top aide said of Hillary's reasoning for sticking by Wasserman Schultz when so many of her senior advisors felt differently. That loyalty had been tested mightily throughout the primaries. Wasserman Schultz had first become a flashpoint and political cudgel for Sanders in the summer of 2015 when the DNC scheduled fewer debates than he wanted. Sanders and his supporters earnestly felt that they weren't getting a fair shake from Wasserman Schultz. But all things considered, she was a convenient foil for a candidate running against the Washington establishment. Hillary's aides had been agitating for some time to make a substitution at the DNC because they didn't have faith in Wasserman Schultz to do her job well. When the subject came up during a debate prep session, Hillary told Podesta it was a non-starter to go after an ally who had supported her in 2008 and was taking incoming fire. "I'm not going to be the one who chops off her head," Hillary said then. Ironically, on a personal level, Wasserman Schultz was in much closer contact with Bernie than with Hillary, Having directly dealt with Sanders and his wife, Jane, on debates, party rules, and platform issues, as well as the Sanders campaign's breach of DNC data, over which Bernie filed and then withdrew a lawsuit against the party. The idea of a biased DNC was part and parcel of Bernie's political argument against Hillary, making it difficult to distinguish the real injuries to him from the perceived variety. Even so, by the time the DNC emails came out, Brooklyn had plenty of pre-existing reason to put distance between the DNC chair and Hillary. The hacked emails might even present the opportunity Mook had been looking for to get rid of her once and for all. But the main concern at the moment was preventing DWS from poisoning Kane's rollout. Brooklyn didn't want the candidate to appear on stage with Wasserman Schultz. The problem was that Wasserman Schultz previously had been given a vague promise that she would have a prominent role in Hillary's next visit to South Florida. As it turned out, this visit was that next time. But for Brooklyn, DWS was a net negative on this day. Wasserman Schultz was told that she wouldn't be able to appear on stage with Hillary. That really pissed her off. She scrambled to reverse the decision, bending the ears of Hillary's Florida State Director Simone Ward, her political director, and anyone else who would listen. She needed a vote of confidence, and she was determined, according to one source, to take her case directly to Hillary. Hillary's aides thought Wasserman Schultz was on another planet, somehow detached from the reality that her days as DNC chairwoman were numbered. She couldn't see that even the decision to give her a few minutes to speak long before Hillary and Kane arrived carried risk for the campaign. Her mere presence, much less photos of Hillary and DWS together, threatened to completely overshadow the main event. Already, the DNC leaks were depriving the Kane announcement of some of its oxygen. By the time Hillary's political director, Amanda Renteria, arrived on the scene, Wasserman Schultz was fuming. Renteria conferred with Ward to get a feel for what they were dealing with, and then sat down with Wasserman Schultz in the main holding room, which was adorned with big-screen TVs and would soon house Clinton, Kane, and their families. Having worked as a Senate chief of staff, Renteria was well-versed in how to carefully manage a political principle.